Hello, I'm Dr. Matthew Davids, and on behalf of CEC Oncology, I'd like to welcome you to today's educational activity titled Advancements in the Management of Relapsed and Refractory B-Cell Malignancies. Today's program is supported by an independent educational grant from Lilly. Today's program is brought to you by CEC Oncology, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians worldwide. Today's activity may include discussions of products or devices that are not currently labeled for use by the U.S. FDA. Again, I'm Matthew Davids. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and leader of the lymphoma program at the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center. I also direct clinical research in the Division of Lymphoma at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. I'm very happy to be joined today by Amy Goodrich, who's a nurse practitioner at the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center in Baltimore, Maryland. Here are our disclosures. Our learning objectives for today are to implement novel treatment options for patients with relapsed refractory CLL and SLL based on the latest clinical trial data, to utilize an evidence-based approach for personalizing treatment for patients with relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma, and lastly, to develop team-based frameworks to oversee and address adverse events, prioritizing patient adherence and active engagement. Today we'll be focusing on these two diseases, chronic lymphocytic leukemia and mantle cell lymphoma. You can see that CLL is more common than mantle cell lymphoma, with close to 21,000 new cases in 2023, whereas mantle cell lymphoma had about 3,400 such cases. The average age of diagnosis is around 60 to 70 years for both diseases, and there is a male-to-female ratio of about 2 to 3 to 1. If you add together the cases of CLL/SLL and mantle cell lymphoma, it comes to close to about a quarter of the total cases of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, as you see represented here in the pie chart. So as we go through the NCCN guidelines for preferred recommendations, we see a lot of common themes between these two diseases. One difference, though, is that with CLL and SLL, we almost never use chemoimmunotherapy anymore. So you can see in the frontline setting, we typically use either continuous treatment with a covalent BTK inhibitor, or a time-limited combination of venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. For second-line treatment of CLL/SLL, we often use the other agent that wasn't used in the frontline setting. And then in the relapsed refractory setting, we have the non-covalent BTK inhibitor pirtobrutinib and CAR T-cell therapy with liso-cel that are both now approved. In mantle cell lymphoma, there is still a role for chemoimmunotherapy in the frontline setting, particularly for younger fit patients who historically have received high-dose therapy and autologous stem cell rescue. Although increasingly we've been using CD20 monoclonal antibody or BTK inhibitor maintenance and avoiding the auto transplant. In mantle cell, we can also use covalent BTK inhibitors or lenalidomide with rituximab in the second line setting. And then we have similar options again in the third line setting and beyond with the non-covalent BTK inhibitor pirtobrutinib or CAR T-cell based therapies. The table at the bottom gives you a sense for the five different BTK inhibitors that we'll be discussing today, including the three approved covalent BTK inhibitors, as well as the approved non-covalent inhibitor pirtobrutinib and nemtabrutinib, which is currently still in clinical development. So let's start with the first portion of the program, which is focused on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And we're going to start with a patient case. I think, Amy, this is a patient that you've seen recently with double refractory disease. So if you could please take us through the case and some of the data supporting your treatment recommendations, that would be great.
Sure. So this is a gentleman who was diagnosed with CLL at age 59. He had a history of hypertension, was otherwise healthy. He was diagnosed with RI stage 1 disease, and his prognostic markers showed normal FISH, unmutated IGHV status, and wild type TP53. So he was observed for about 3 years and gradually developed cytopenias and some bulkier adenopathy. At age 62, he needed frontline therapy for CLL. So he was started on ibrutinib and quickly achieved a very good partial response. And he remained on ibrutinib in a stable remission for about 8 years. So around age 70, he began developing bulky progressive adenopathy on ibrutinib. We repeated his genetic testing, and the only change was he now has a TP53 mutation. So as you described, we use the regimen we didn't use first line in second line, and he starts venetoclax with an anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. He achieves a partial response, and at the end of therapy, he has undetectable minimal residual disease, and he's got very small residual adenopathy that's PET negative, so he gets into a really good remission. After 2 years on venetoclax and his monoclonal, he develops steadily progressive lymph nodes. They're now bulky. And so, how are we thinking about this patient? So he has double refractory disease, and double refractory disease is defined as, of course, double refractory to a BTK inhibitor, and venetoclax can be used in any combinations in any lines of therapy, just having had both of those. Patients must have progressed on a BTK inhibitor, so different from intolerance, so progression on therapy. And then there are three combinations of venetoclax refractoriness. So they either can progress to be defined as double refractory, have progression on venetoclax, progression within 24 months of completing a venetoclax-based regimen, or being resistant to venetoclax retreatment. And again, it doesn't matter whether we're starting with a BTK and going to venetoclax, or doing it the other way around, or even using a BTK with venetoclax as a therapy together. So those are the combinations of how you can become or define double refractory disease. And so why this matters is because these patients do not do well. So this group looked at just under 400 patients who discontinued a covalent BTK inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor. And looking at the survival probability, this is pretty dismal at 5.5 months. Now, this data is from 2021, so we now have other options for these folks, which we are going to talk about. But clearly, this is where we still have a very big need, is for these patients who have been exposed to covalent BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors. We need a much deeper toolbox of therapies than we have now. We're getting better, but we're not there, but we're doing better. And so in this same vein, and this is from 2022, so again, this is a few years old now. If this group looked at patients who had had a BTK inhibitor, a covalent BTK inhibitor, and venetoclax, so this double refractory group, and looked at folks who got CAR T, and if you look at this and allotransplant, and we're going to go through these, but if you look at the numbers of patients treated, these are relatively small numbers of patients, but nonetheless, those who got CAR T in a double refractory state, overall response rate of 85%. But that median progression-free survival is pretty short at 4 months. Allotransplant, again, good overall response rate at 76.5%, but only 11 months progression-free survival. Where the data looks best is this non-covalent BTK inhibitor, and that was most typically pirtobrutinib, but 75% overall response rate. And at 9 months median follow-up, so the longest median follow-up in this data set, the progression-free survival not yet reached. And then if you look at our PI3 kinase inhibitor group and chemoimmunotherapy group, those overall response rates are quite low, 40 and 31%, and the median progression-free survival of 5 and 3 months, respectively. So very short responses with these regimens. So this group looked at subsequent lines of therapy, doing an electronic medical record retrospective review starting in 2016, and the data cutoff was 2003. And they looked at patients who had CLL, and the data suggested that patients who received a first-line covalent BTK inhibitor, followed by a BCL2 inhibitor with an anti-CD20 monoclonal, had the greatest overall survival benefit. But when they looked at what patients were getting, very few patients had received those two lines of therapy in sequentially. So first and second line, there was still a lot of chemoimmunotherapy being given. There was still a lot of single-agent anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies being given. it was somewhere in the 30% of patients who actually received a first-line covalent BTK followed by a BCL2 inhibitor with a monoclonal. And then just to point out, our novel treatments that we'll be talking about were largely unavailable to these patients because of the data cutoff. And so where do we stand with therapy for double refractory disease? Matt, do you want to talk about how you treat your double refractory folks?
Yeah, so you know this is a growing problem. We're seeing more and more of these patients in the clinic, and unfortunately, there's few good options. You know, we've seen sort of historically that the median time to discontinuation of the immediate subsequent line of therapy in these double refractory patients is in the range of about 5.5 months. And that's time to subsequent line of therapy or death. So, you know, these are patients who often have very aggressive disease. We've seen novel mutations in BCL2, for example, in the venetoclax-resistant patients. We know about the BTK and PLC gamma-2 mutations in patients resistant to ibrutinib and the other covalent BTK inhibitors. So, challenging population, but happy to say that there are some promising options that are being explored now. We'll talk about the idea of venetoclax retreatment for patients who previously had a time-limited course of venetoclax. We'll talk about the non-covalent BTK inhibitors, CAR T-cell therapy, and then other targeted therapies in development. So let's start with venetoclax-based retreatment. Is this an option for our patients? Well, there's accumulating data that, in fact, yes, this could be an option. Most of these are retrospective data. For example, this study that was a real-world collaboration, but also included some patients from clinical trials. And these were patients who had been treated with a venetoclax-based regimen once, which they called VEN1 in this analysis, and then went on to subsequently receive a second venetoclax-based therapy in a later line. And you can see the median age of these patients is pretty young, at time of diagnosis in their mid-50s, but at the time of their first venetoclax, kind of mid-60s, male predominance as usual. Median of two prior lines of therapy in this analysis, and you can see it's a pretty heavily pretreated group and also genetically enriched for high-risk disease, with at least a quarter of the patients having deletion 17p and over 80% having IGHV unmutated disease. So a relatively small group of about 46 patients. You can see on the left side there, the overall response rate to their first venetoclax therapy was very high, close to 90% when you add up the PRs and the CRs. And then you see the overall response rate to the second round of venetoclax is a bit lower. In the BTK inhibitor exposed patients, it's 56%. So still the majority are responding, but not as robustly as in the first time they got venetoclax. On the right, you can see that median progression-free survival comes out at around 2 years or so from that second course of venetoclax. So we certainly do need prospective data sets here. We're actually currently running a study called REVEN-G, or retreatment with VEN-G. GA101 is the old name for obinutuzumab, to look at this prospectively. But I do think based on retrospective data sets like this, it does suggest that we can see a high overall response rate and reasonable durability with venetoclax-based retreatment, even in this double exposed or double refractory population. Now, what about the non-covalent BTK inhibitors? So I'll just briefly mention nemtabrutinib because it's not yet FDA approved, but I think it's important to know that this is a promising agent that is now in late phases of clinical development. What I'm showing you here are some data from the phase 1-2 open label study of nemtabrutinib, which focused on patients with double refractory disease. Cohort A included patients with two or more prior lines of therapy, including a covalent BTK inhibitor, who were documented to have a BTK C481 mutation, resistance mutation. Cohort B was a similar population, but did include patients who were intolerant to a covalent BTKI or those without a C481 mutation. And you can see the progression-free survival curves here, I think overall look promising. I would say particularly in those BTK mutated patients, lighter green, where the median PFS was in the range of 26 months. Those patients who were completely double refractory, the prior BTK and BCL2 had a median PFS that was significantly shorter at about 10 months. So I think it does suggest that this is an active drug, and we're eager to see, you know, more data with it and phase 3 data on the way. Now we have more data for pirtobrutinib, which is the non-covalent BTK inhibitor that has received accelerated approval already in the relapsed refractory CLL population with at least two prior lines of therapy, including a covalent BTK inhibitor. And that approval was based on the Bruin study, a phase 1-2 open-label trial of pirtobrutinib monotherapy, where they looked at close to 250 patients with CLL who were pretty heavily pretreated with a median of three prior lines of therapy. They all had had prior covalent BTK inhibitor, Most of them had had prior chemoimmunotherapy, and just over 40% of these patients had also had prior venetoclax. You can see close to 40% of the patients had TP53 aberration, and 85% had unmutated IGHV. So genetically, a very high-risk group, and nearly 40% had a resistance mutation in BTK, such as C481. About a quarter of the patients on the Bruin study had discontinued their prior BTKI due to toxicity, and about three quarters due to progression. So here you can see the progression-free survival for the patients on the Bruin study treated with pirtobrutinib, which does look promising with a median PFS reached at around 19 months or so, 19.6 months in the previous covalent BTK inhibitor treated population. If you look at the subset of patients who had prior covalent BTKI and venetoclax, it's about 100 patients. The median PFS is just under 17 months in that group. And you're seeing response rates here sort of in the 80% range, again, in a very heavily pretreated group that's difficult to treat. So we just reviewed two options. We talked about venetoclax-based treatment and post-covalent BTK inhibitor, and we talked about pirtobrutinib. How do these two approaches stack up? The short answer is we don't really know based on any kind of prospective randomized data. And this, I think, is a good scenario to think about a matched-adjusted indirect comparison or MAIC analysis, which tries to look across different studies and match the pre-baseline characteristics of the patients as much as possible to try to see how these therapies may compare. So a lot of caveats to this type of analysis. The patient populations are different. It was, some of these data sets come from different eras. But nonetheless, I think it does give you a sense that either of these options can be effective in the BTK inhibitor pretreated population. To me, these numbers look pretty similar, suggesting that either can really be a good approach for our patients. And we'll await additional larger and comparative data sets to understand the nuances of which regimen may be better for which patients. Now, a newer data set that just came out at the ASH 2024 meeting is the Bruin CLL-321 trial, which is the registrational trial for pirtobrutinib in the relapsed refractory setting. This is a phase 3 study comparing continuous pirtobrutinib monotherapy to investigator's choice of a standard 6-month course of bendamustine and rituximab, or to continuous treatment with the PI3 kinase delta inhibitor idelalisib given with an initial 6-month combination with rituximab. And the primary outcome for this study is PFS. We saw that, in general, the pirtobrutinib regimen was very well tolerated. You do see some cytopenias and infectious complications, as is true for any regimen in CLL. But overall, the rates of discontinuation due to treatment-related AEs, as well as dose reductions, were significantly lower with the pirtobrutinib arm compared to the investigator's choice arm. Interestingly also, even though it's a BTK inhibitor, there was very low rate of cardiovascular side effects with pirtobrutinib on this Bruin 321 study. For example, 2.6% AFib flutter, 6% hypertension, and a low rate of bleeding issues. In the lower left, you can see in the PFS comparison that pirtobrutinib was superior to idelalisib rituximab or bendamustine and rituximab, both in terms of progression-free survival and time to next treatment. And in fact, the median time to next treatment was a little over 2 years in that pirtobrutinib arm, suggesting that these responses can be durable. The overall survival analysis is not yet mature for this study. So rather than using pirtobrutinib or venetoclax sort of in sequence, what about the idea of combination pirtobrutinib-venetoclax? This is being explored in a number of different studies. We've seen data from this phase 1b trial of pirtobrutinib-venetoclax, PV, in 15 patients, or pirtobrutinib venetoclax rituximab, PVR, in 10 patients with a 25-cycle regimen. Again, a heavily pretreated group with a median of two prior therapies, nearly 70% with covalent BTK inhibitor exposure and close to 40% with BTK resistance mutations. Again, the majority of the patients in this study here had progressed on their covalent BTK inhibitor. And nonetheless, you see 93 to 100% of the patients responding here. You do see some CRs as well as PRs. We don't know as much yet about the durability of these responses, but it certainly does suggest that pirtobrutinib and venetoclax can be a very potent combination, even in this post-covalent BTK inhibitor setting. And this was also a very well-tolerated combination. And I'll highlight also that pirtobrutinib and venetoclax is now being explored in the frontline setting in trials that are getting underway, such as the CLL18 study in Europe. Now, I also mentioned that we have CAR T-cell therapy approved for CLL. And the product here is Lysocell. This is the CD19-directed autologous CAR T product. And the data here supporting it in CLL come from this study, TRANSCEND CLL-004. So these were relapsed refractory CLL or SLL patients with at least two prior lines of therapy. They all had prior covalent BTK inhibitor-based therapy, and then many of these patients also had prior venetoclax. You can see the typical schema here for CAR T-cell-based study where patients underwent screening and then harvesting with lymphodepletion and then subsequent reinfusion of the cells. Interestingly, there were cohorts here that had combination of lysocell with venetoclax. We haven't seen those data yet. And then lysocell with ibrutinib, and we've seen some data from that cohort now as well. And the primary endpoint of this study is the rate of CR/CRI. So here you can see the data from lysocell monotherapy, which was published in The Lancet in 2023. 49 patients in this study had prior venetoclax and covalent BTK inhibitor exposure and were treated at dose level 2 of CAR T cells here. And the overall response rate was 43%, but the primary endpoint was a bit lower. The rate of IRCSS CR or CRI was 18%. You can see the undetectable MRD rate in the marrow was close to 60%. So these patients were having deep responses. But overall, you know, this was a shorter progression-free survival than many of us had expected. And you can see that here with the PFS curves. So really, these curves are brought down by the patients who didn't respond, and there were quite a few of them. And in the non-responders, the median PFS was only 3.7 months. Now, on the other hand, in the small number of patients who did achieve CR or CRI, you can see that top light blue curve, the median has not been reached. And in fact, there were no progression events in the first 2 years in those patients who achieved CR. There does seem to be a benefit to achieving at least a PR. Median PFS there was just under 27 months. So overall, the median PFS is in the range of about 18 months. On the right, you can see the overall survival. So with a median follow-up of about 2 years, again, kind of similar trends. You don't see any of the patients who achieved CR having died. You do see a benefit to PR, and the median overall survival is about 43 months. So it's not bad considering that this is a very difficult to treat population. You know, that being said, for patients who don't achieve a CR, it can be very challenging to have a durable response. So there's been a number of efforts underway to try to enhance the activity of lysocell, and we've now seen some initial data from this lysocell plus ibrutinib cohort that was presented at the ASH meeting in 2024. This was 56 patients who were treated with ibrutinib sort of throughout that period that I showed you of initiation and lymphodepletion and the subsequent period of engraftment of the CAR T-cell product. And they received ibrutinib for about 6 months after that CAR T-cell reinfusion. Now, interestingly, here the median has not been reached in terms of overall survival, median PFS in the range of about 31 months. And you can see that the CR rate is 45%, which looks significantly higher than that 18% we saw with lysocell monotherapy. Similarly, the overall response rate here is high at 86%, and 84% of patients did achieve undetectable MRD in the marrow. So, you know, it's difficult to kind of compare across these cohorts. I would say that this cohort with ibrutinib was a little bit less heavily pretreated than the lysocell monotherapy cohort, but I think there really might be something to this data set, both in terms of reducing the CLL disease burden with the BTK inhibitor, but also potentially some of the immunomodulatory effects of BTK inhibition. And so I think this is certainly inspiring for developing larger data sets of combination of BTK inhibitor plus lysocell. So let's get back to our case. You know, one of the major considerations we have in treatment decision making for patients in later lines of therapy is the impact of adverse events. So Amy, I want to bring you back in here and see if you can help kind of walk us through the range of adverse events that patients who are receiving BTK inhibitors might experience and sort of how those are managed in the clinical setting.
Sure. So to look at common or problematic BTK inhibitor toxicities, you have already alluded, Matt, to the fact that cytopenias and infections are just a way of life with these patient populations. And I put fatigue in that category as well. So some of the toxicities are from off-target effects. And so as we have now first, second, and third generation BTK inhibitors, each generation has fewer off-target effects and are generally more well-tolerated and have lower incidences of some of these toxicities. One of the biggest problematic off-target effects is EGFR, which all those of you who see solid tumors, you know, are responsible for arthralgias and diarrhea and rashes and skin changes. And those are definitely seen with BTK inhibitors because of those EGFR off-target effects. Some of the cardiac events are not as well understood in terms of the etiology, but they include very rarely ventricular arrhythmias and relatively infrequently AFib and A-flutter. Hypertension can be seen, and that is the one toxicity that becomes more prevalent with time. The others either plateau or become better with time. And then bleeding is an issue that we will talk about in a few slides here, but this is just a Cliff's Note version of the toxicities that are most problematic or common. So in terms of serious adverse events, although low-level bleeding is very common with these disease, hemorrhage can be seen, AFib, A-flutter, and we're going to talk about this later, but it is really risk factors that are common to everyone, older folks, males, all sorts of cardiovascular diagnoses such as AFib, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, pre-existing cardiac disease. This is not special to the CLL population. This is in the general population, things that put folks at a higher risk of AFib or A-flutter. We talked about infections. Those can be serious, including opportunistic infections. Those cytopenias can be more severe. And then, you know, we're always worried about second primary malignancies. And if you look at the data on our four approved BTK inhibitors, it is skin cancers and non-melanoma skin cancers that are the most prevalent. Solid tumors are definitely seen as well, but there's not a pattern to those. They're sort of all over the solid tumors that are seen. It's the skin cancer that tends to be the most common. Another common side effect, and this occurs in up to 50% of patients, depending which BTK inhibitor is being used, is this lymphocytosis. And this is due to lymphocyte redistribution. And so what happens is as a patient starts these therapies, nodes and spleens will decrease and those lymphocytes push out into the peripheral blood. And so you will see lymphocytosis. This typically peaks early at the first month or two. It's typically a slow decline downward. There are patients who the lymphocytosis never resolves, and it doesn't affect outcomes. It doesn't mean anything. It's not prognostic of any outcome. And it really does not require any specific management, even when it is persistent. As long as you're seeing those nodes in the spleen and other objective nodal masses decreasing, the lymphocytosis is just something that we have to ride out, and it may or may not improve, but it's definitely something that patients need to be aware of because this is really disturbing, especially those folks who have, you know, 10 years of Excel spreadsheets of their lymphocyte counts. This is something they need to be ready for. Bleeding, which we've talked about, and typically is mild. For grade 1 or 2 bleeding, you can hold. You don't necessarily have to hold. You can continue to monitor. You've got to tailor it to the patient. Grade 3 or above, you're going to hold. You can consider transfusing platelets, and then you can dose reduce once bleeding resolves. If you're using a first generation, you can move to a second generation as well if patients have significant bleeding. And then one of the most important teaching points is this holding for procedures, holding 3 days before and after minor procedures, 7 days before and after major procedures because of that bleeding risk. AFib, A-flutter, and like I spoke about, this is a relatively low volume problem, about 10% in the RESONATE-2 trial with ibrutinib. The time to onset is just under 3 months, but this can really occur at any point in time. And in addition to there being no special CLL-related risk factors, there's really not special management either in terms of what you do to control the AFib. Certainly cardiology should get involved. If the CHA2DS2-VAD score is low, you can continue the BTK inhibitor at the current dose with using rate and rhythm control, of course, being aware of drug-drug interactions and trying to choose beta blockers to avoid those drug-drug interactions. And then for higher CHADS-VAD scores, holding the BTK inhibitor, considering alternative therapy at that point. And then if you do need to anticoagulate, really trying to avoid warfarin and using DOACs or low molecular weight heparin, things with shorter half-lives are preferable. And then other issues, so diarrhea is common, you know, just using over-the-counter antidiarrheals is typically a good approach. Headaches are pretty classic with acalabrutinib, and it's usually self-limited within the first few months. They come and go, and it's acetaminophen and caffeine that tend to do the best job. And of course, avoiding NSAIDs because of that bleeding risk, hypertension. So this, again, is the one issue that does tend to be more prevalent as time goes on. So we're monitoring for treatment emergent hypertension. We're managing with antihypertensives, largely dependent upon other comorbidities. And then just know that when the BTK inhibitor therapy is stopped, it is very likely that the patients are going to be able to reduce or come off those antihypertensives. We talked about infections, and there is no blanket prophylaxis, and you really are looking at the patient in front of you, what's their treatment history, what is their infection history, and you are tailoring any prophylaxis to the patient. Arthralgias and myalgias tend to be mild, but can be some of the most problematic issues to deal with. These are very subjective. They may require dose reduction, dose interruption, sometimes a pulse of steroids, and again, you know, acetaminophen. But these can be some of the most frustrating issues to try to get a handle on. Nausea, anti-emetics tend to do a good job. If it's daily dosing, taking at night helps. We talked about those cytopenias, and so I follow the package insert. If for neutropenia, patients may require growth factor. You can dose interrupt. Same for thrombocytopenia. And then rashes using topical steroids, oral antihistamines. There's really not specific management of these issues. This is really in line with lots of drugs that we're giving and managing those the same way. And then, so in looking at, again, the matched indirect comparison of side effects, venetoclax versus pirtobrutinib, because again, this is where we're, you know, once a patient progresses through a covalent BTK inhibitor, are we giving venetoclax? Are we giving pirtobrutinib? And so looking at those toxicities, you can see anemia is higher in the venetoclax group, 28% versus 5% in the pirtobrutinib group. Febrile neutropenia is also higher in venetoclax. Neutropenia is higher in venetoclax, as is thrombocytopenia. Pneumonia is in the unweighted pirtobrutinib group is pretty similar to venetoclax, and then treatment discontinuations due to adverse events are also, again, in the unweighted pirtobrutinib group are pretty similar. So in general, you know, as a blanket, it appears that pirtobrutinib is more well tolerated than venetoclax, but again, this is not head to head. This is, you know, matched, adjusted, indirect comparisons. Then looking at CAR-T, our lysocell, so looking at cytokine release syndrome, 85% of patients will be expected to develop CRS. And as you can see, the majority are grade 1 and 2, only 8% is grade 3, and there was no grade 4 seen. And if you go to the grid at the bottom, median time to onset is 4 days, and the median time to resolution is about 6 days. And then for our neurotoxicities, only 45% of patients can be expected to have those. There is a little higher incidence of grade 3 at 18%, but the majority are grade 1 and 2. And then there was a 1% grade 4 incidence. And that happens about 7 days into the therapy and lasts about 7 days. And then if you look at the bottom of those 100 patients, 82 required steroids and or tocilizumab for management of CRS or neurotoxicity. And then our other adverse events, of course, these are pretty typical for CAR T therapy: cytopenias, infections, hypogammaglobulinemia, tumor lysis syndrome, that second primary malignancy issue, and then macrophage activation syndrome. And in looking at deaths, there was really only one death directly related to the lysosel, which was an MAS death. The others were considered unrelated, and you can see respiratory failure, sepsis, and different infections there. And so let's jump back to our case. And here we're having to decide what to do after covalent BTK and venetoclax failures. And so, Matt, how do prior adverse events affect your choice of therapy? How do expected adverse events affect your choice of therapy?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. So these are clearly important factors as we counsel patients about the next line of therapy. You know, a lot of these BTK inhibitor-related toxicities are class effects, I would say, particularly bleeding issues. So if someone's had a very serious bleeding issue on a BTK inhibitor, I'm probably not going to prioritize a BTK inhibitor in a later line of therapy unless I'm really out of other options. On the other hand, if I had a patient who had some mild arthralgias with a BTK inhibitor, I'd certainly be happy to try a different BTK inhibitor in the next line of therapy. And it's sort of a similar approach with venetoclax. You know, if I had a patient who really struggled with neutropenia and infections on their first line venetoclax, and they've gone through covalent BTKI, you know, I may not want to retreat them with venetoclax as the next option. I may think about a non-covalent BTK inhibitor. On the other hand, if I had a patient who did great with frontline venetoclax, had a very long initial remission, and then now is in the sort of third line setting, that could be a great patient to go back to venetoclax. So I think it really depends on the type of toxicity, the severity of the toxicity, and these definitely impact our recommendations. All right, so let's go back and kind of recap where we're at with our patient here. So remember, this is initially a 62-year-old man who was on ibrutinib for about 8 years and got a great response from that, now age 70 and has TP53 aberrant CLL, goes on to venetoclax for a couple years, but now is progressing. So what would I recommend for this patient? I would say, you know, this is potentially a good patient for CAR-T. This patient's still early 70s, pretty fit. Maybe you'd get a durable response, but on the other hand, as we saw, only an 18% CR rate with lysosel, and you kind of really need to get to CR in order to be able to achieve durable response. So I've started having these conversations with patients. I would say most of them so far have been choosing pirtobrutinib, which I think is also a great option. Certainly easy to start, well-tolerated, and high likelihood of helping. And you know, this is a patient where I might start with pirtobrutinib and then be prepared to move to lysosel in the next line of therapy if they start to progress while on pirtobrutinib. All right, so let's transition now to talk briefly about mantle cell lymphoma, including some recent data and a case. So this case is a 55-year-old woman who presents with advanced stage 4B mantle cell lymphoma with some thrombocytopenia and splenomegaly. She has some other medical comorbidities, as you see listed here. And so she undergoes frontline treatment with an aggressive chemo immunotherapy regimen, hyper-CVAD with rituximab, and achieves a complete response. And she gets consolidated with an auto transplant, and as is typical, kind of relapses about 5 years later. So the patient's now about 60 and goes on ibrutinib, does well for a couple years, but has now developed steady progression of the lymph node disease, and they're now quite bulky. So what are the treatment options for this patient? What would you recommend? And let's review some of the data now to help understand that. So first, just to talk briefly about the OASIS study. This is a kind of interesting study that's combining ibrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab in various arms, also an ibrutinib, obinutuzumab arm as well. It's a bit of a hodgepodge of a study because it includes both newly diagnosed mantle cell patients as well as patients who have relapsed after auto transplant. And you can see the three arms here. The primary outcome here was safety because this was an early phase study, but there were secondary efficacy outcomes. Across the board, across these three different cohorts, you saw high overall response rates in the 70 to 90% range or so. And they have reasonable follow-up now at this point. So 6-year PFS in the two relapsed cohorts was about 40 to 53%. And in that frontline cohort, it's an 80% 5-year PFS. So this certainly does suggest that these different drugs, when combined together in various ways, can achieve high responses and also reasonable durability. And so these are all good things to consider. You know, that being said, this type of IVO triplet therapy is not an approved regimen for mantle cell lymphoma. Now, what about pirtobrutinib in relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma? So we do have data from the Bruin study of mantle cell looking with a median follow-up of about 8 months that you can see about 60% of patients had an ongoing response at that analysis. We recently saw some updated data from this study in the 90 patients pretreated with a covalent BTK inhibitor, now with a median follow-up of about 12 months, and median duration of response is in the range of about 22 months. At the time of the analysis, close to a third of patients were ongoing in response, and the longest ongoing response was over 2 years. And I think it's important to point out that the pirtobrutinib responses were also observed in patients post-auto stem cell transplant and post-CAR T-cell therapy. What about pirtobrutinib in the real-world setting for mantle cell lymphoma? So relatively limited data here, but there is a compassionate use program that predated the approval of pirtobrutinib, and there were 10 patients who were tracked in that program, very heavily pretreated group of patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma with a median of 3 prior lines of therapy. But nonetheless, a 70% overall response rate, which is pretty similar, as you can see in the table, to what was observed in the Bruin study. You can see that the 12-month duration of response was 71% outside of the clinical trial setting, and 12-month PFS of 56%. So I think this does suggest that the promising results that were seen in the Bruin study do apply outside of a clinical trial setting. Now, what about the real-world efficacy of subsequent lines of therapy, for example, CAR T-cell therapy? It is pretty common to see an initial response with CAR T-cell therapy, but it's that duration of response that's quite variable. And so there's now a number of different options that the NCCN guidelines list for this population. You can see that post-covalent BTK inhibitor, you can use a non-covalent inhibitor, you can use CAR T-cell-based therapy, you can use lenalidomide rituximab. But from this French registry, a retrospective study with about 15 months of follow-up, you can see that post-CAR T-cell, the response rates are lower than what we're accustomed to seeing with these regimens pre-CAR T-cell. So with lenalidomide rituximab, for example, only a 19% overall response rate. Chemoimmunotherapy, 23%. A little bit better when you get with the bispecific antibodies like a CD3, CD20 bispecific, 43% overall response rate. You can see response with radiation, but that's often kind of just for more localized progression events. And so this is an area where we need more data, but certainly the early data do suggest that in the post-CAR T-cell setting that the options are quite limited. So let's go back to our patient now and sort of thinking about the available options. Remember, this is still a relatively young patient who's now 62 years old. She's been through intensive induction therapy for frontline treatment and then ibrutinib for about 2 years. And we can think about what we'd recommend for this patient. You know, I would say this is a patient where we're kind of debating between CAR T-cell therapy or non-covalent BTK inhibitor with pirtobrutinib. I think largely it's a similar discussion as what I have with my CLL patients in that, you know, often pirtobrutinib is the easier option logistically. It's likely to work for a period of time. And so most patients, I think, are choosing pirtobrutinib first, but with the knowledge that that's not going to last forever and that they need to be thinking ahead to next steps and preparing for CAR T-cell therapy if they progress on pirtobrutinib. So it's certainly rewarding to see that we've made really excellent progress in the treatment of both relapsed refractory CLL and mantle cell lymphoma. But of course, these therapies aren't going to help patients if the patients can't get access to the therapies. So Amy, you work with a lot of patients. You know, tell us a bit about some of the practical challenges that you faced in helping your patients to access these novel therapies.
Oh yeah, so they are real and they are many. And so if you look at these U.S. cancer disparities, we are all aware of disparities that exist in this country. Unfortunately, some of them are environmental. You can see here: air, water, transportation, housing, community safety. We have food deserts. We have communities where people have no green spaces. There are behavioral factors. You know, tobacco use, smoking in general, diet, body weight, activity levels, adherence to screening and vaccinations. There are social factors: education level, income, employment, health literacy. The list goes on. There are clinical factors. Do you have access to healthcare? What is the quality of that healthcare? There are cultural factors and cultural health beliefs. There is, you know, a growing issue in this country with mental health issues and stress in general. And then, you know, the one thing that we can't change very readily are our biological and genetic factors. But this is really a multifactorial issue of disparity in this country. And so what that means is the barriers to cancer care, they may be insurance or financial. They may be that you have to drive 3 hours to your healthcare provider. You don't have healthcare providers in your immediate vicinity. You don't have access to screening or treatment. Do you have transportation? Are there cultural or language issues? We need robust education materials and programs to support people of all cultures and languages. And then we all know that patients do better if they have healthcare providers who look like them and speak the languages they do. And then this educational and psychosocial support needs to be accessible to patients as well. So again, multifactorial, very complex issues that are barriers to cancer care. But much of this is out of our control, but some of it that is within our control is shared decision making. And as Matt has done a great job outlining here, is we have growing numbers of therapies and growing numbers of very good therapies. And there's no cookie cutter here. So this shared decision making of seeking the patient's participation and having them understand and explore and compare those treatment options, really assessing their preferences and reaching a decision with the patient and evaluating with the patient is the key to optimizing adherence, drug adherence, visit adherence, and improving outcomes in these patients. So for example, starting a patient on a BTK inhibitor, most of us are in a multidisciplinary team. Hopefully all of us are working in a multidisciplinary team, and we really do need consistent messaging to avoid confusion. Patient and caregiver counseling is part of getting a patient started on these therapies. And we're saying BTK inhibitor therapy, but this is any therapy, and particularly these oral drugs that we are relying on patients to take and be adherent with at home. And then we need patient follow-up and continuity of care. And, this is getting to side effects early and getting them managed before they are significant. And so segueing into continuity of care. So continuity of care is the extent to which healthcare services are received and coordinated. And so this is really looking at patient outcomes based on resource utilization. And so this group looked at Optum's healthcare claims database using this HHI index, which is a tool that is used for quality control in real world data sets. And then, of course, the continuity of care scale. And this group looked at just under 5,000 patients with CLL, and 77.5% of them received a first line covalent BTK inhibitor. So when we looked at scores, and the score range, for those of you who are not familiar with these scores, are 0 to 1.0. And so the bottom line was, with every 0.1 unit increase in the continuity of care score, so resource utilization and looking at patient outcomes and their resource utilization. So for patients who had better continuity of care, their odds of an ER visit were lower, their total ER visits were lower, and the same was true for inpatient hospitalizations. The odds were lower, the numbers were lower, and there was a lower hazard of death. So clearly, good patient adherence and good follow-up is making a difference in their healthcare utilization outside of our clinics. And so this leads us to this team-based approach and why this is so important with the patient and the caregivers in the middle, and all of us and all of our colleagues in our practices, and our colleagues in different specialists, our medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, hematologists, our nurses, our NPs and PAs, our pharmacists, our social workers, It may be nutritionists. We may need our GI folks to help us. This is really critical for managing these patients. And so, Matt, do you want to take us into our summary?
Sure. Thanks, Amy. Great summary there. And so just to kind of wrap up, I think we're almost out of time here. So I'm going to kind of just give a brief summary of what we've discussed today. So, you know, first, BTK inhibitors clearly are now being widely used across multiple hematologic malignancies, as you saw here with CLL and MCL. We have robust data sets now that we know that covalent BTK inhibitors are generally safe and effective drugs, and that non-covalent BTK inhibitors can overcome resistance to the covalent BTK inhibitors. To some degree, all these BTK inhibitors do have somewhat similar expected side effect profiles. There's clearly some class effects here, but there is variation between these different BTK inhibitors in terms of the frequency and severity of those side effects. With all these different options, shared decision-making really is needed now, and comprehensive and ongoing patient education, as well as diligent monitoring, is critical to optimize patient outcomes. So lastly, we'd like to leave you with some SMART goals, which are smart, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely, and are intended to be actions that you can take back to your clinical practice starting today or tomorrow. So the three SMART goals that we wanted to review are that first, incorporate the latest clinical trial data regarding next generation non-covalent BTK inhibitors into the care of patients with CLL, SLL, and mantle cell lymphoma, as documented by treatment selection in patient EHR charts. Second, to improve management of potential AEs from treatment, and provide clear patient education on steps that may mitigate AE severity. Third, to provide ideal patient care by involving the whole patient care team. Document shared decision-making, patient education, potential barriers to care, and guideline concordant therapy administration in patient EHR charts. To receive CME CE credit for today's program, complete the post-test and evaluation. You'll be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Again, thank you for joining us both today, and thank you for providing the very best care for your patients with CLL and MCL.